Iran's foreign minister said the positive developments in JCPOA revival talks in Vienna fall short of Tehran's expectations. Fresh anti-racism protests erupt in U.S. cities as sparked by the fatal police shooting of a young African-American in Minneapolis. Demonstrations against COVID restrictions that are spreading in Canada, with Ottawa police chief calling it a nationwide insurrection. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, Iran saying that there have been positive developments in the JCPOA revival talks that are held in Vienna, but that they do not fulfill the Islamic Republic's expectations. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made an announcement in a telephone conversation with European Union's policy chief, Joseph Borrell. He says that the 2015 deal has not had any economic benefits for Iran in recent years. Amir Abdollahian says that Iran is firmly and explicitly seeking a good deal that would guarantee its economic benefits in a reliable and sustainable manner. Iran and the remaining JCPOA signatories have been engaged in talks in Vienna to revive the accord. In the latest development, Washington has announced the restoration of a sanction waiver, but Iranian officials say that the U.S. should show its goodwill and practice by removing all its anti-Iran sanctions. Well, we'll talk to history professor and also political commentator David Yacoubian for his comments regarding those developments. And he says that the JCPOA would only revive if it benefits Iran economically.
Amir Abdollahian is, of course, stating and repeating the obvious, that it's only going to be verifiable and sustainable sanctions relief that brings Iran fully back into accordance with the JCPOA if it can be saved. And the State Department release is very specific. It says that this is not a quid pro quo, that this does not necessarily benefit Iran, but it explicitly says that even if the JCPOA is not returned to fully, if both sides don't return to full implementation, and I'm closely paraphrasing here, it will still assist us in our non-proliferation efforts. Therefore, this potentially benefits the United States if the JCPOA is not returned to. It does indeed facilitate the ultimate return to full implementation by both sides, and therefore, to Amir Abdollahian's point, it's still moving in the right direction, but no, indeed, this doesn't provide Iran with anything, and what Iran is looking for is verifiable, sustainable sanctions relief. Even a full year after Donald Trump pulled out in May of 2018, Iran maintained all of its commitments under the agreement, despite the fact that it never achieved the goal of the agreement for Iran in the first place, which was sanctions relief. So thankfully, I think we're at a point where the Iranian negotiating team, quite seasoned, and quite skilled regarding the various tricks and shenanigans, if you will, that the United States is going to try to pull off here. We're either going to return to a JCPOA that benefits Iran economically, or we will not be returning to the agreement.
Now, an Iranian senior official says that more needs to be done in order to clinch a deal as part of sanction removal talks held in Vienna. In a tweet, Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, said that although limited headway has been made in the negotiations, striking a balance in the commitments of the parties involved is essential. He said the political decisions at the White House are a precursor to reaching a balance as well as a good agreement. The U.S. has restored some sanctions waivers that will allow other countries to cooperate with Iran on its nuclear projects. Tehran has called on all parties to the talks, as well as the U.S., to make good on their obligations in order for the talks to be fruitful. The negotiating teams that are now in their capitals are expected back in Vienna in the coming days to continue the eighth round of the talks. A crippling siege on Yemen has taken its toll on civilians, and children seem to be bearing the brunt, unfortunately. Authorities are warning that a Saudi blockade has put over 3,000 kids with cancer at risk of dying. The health minister says that nuclear medicine cannot be shipped into the country due to the siege that has been in place since 2015. The medication is desperately needed for cancer treatment. Taha al-Mutawakkil demands an urgent reopening of Sana'a Airport to allow patients to travel abroad for treatment. He says that the use of prohibited weapons by the Saudi-led coalition has doubled the number of cancer patients in Yemen. The number of children suffering from blood cancer is also increasing dramatically. Now, the U.S. administration has changed hands between Democrats and Republicans since the outbreak of the Saudi-led war on Yemen in 2015, but no matter which government holds the reign at the White House, the U.S. is still sticking to the same policies regarding Yemen. More than 7 years on, the U.S. continues to provide the coalition states with unwavering military and diplomatic support, making itself complicit in the Yemen war crimes. Now, in this report, we'll review how three U.S. administrations missed their chances to end one of the world's bloodiest wars.
When Saudi Arabia launched an air campaign on Yemen in March 2015, it assured the U.S. administration of President Barack Obama that it would oust the Ansarullah movement within months. But the war, aimed at restoring a former friendly government in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, dragged on with limited military gains. Under Obama, whose government had close bonds with Saudi Arabia, indiscriminate and disproportionate airstrikes continued on Yemen. Homes, markets, schools, hospitals, weddings, and funerals were targeted with U.S.-made weapons, including widely banned cluster munitions. An all-out Saudi blockade exacerbated Yemen's health and nutrition crises, and diseases like cholera began to spread like wildfire. And all those happened amid military and diplomatic support provided by the Obama administration. The U.S. also stood silent in 2016 when Saudi Arabia, through threats of cutting funds to the UN, finally forced the world body to drop it from its list of the worst offenders against children for its attacks on Yemeni kids. Obama lost all chances to stop this slaughter. Donald Trump followed in the footsteps of his predecessor in supporting Saudi Arabia and made his first trip as U.S. president to the Arab Kingdom. Hours after landing in the Saudi capital Riyadh on the 20th of May 2017, Trump sealed a $350 billion arms deal with King Salman, the largest in world history. The transaction included tanks, combat ships, missile defense systems, as well as radar, communications, and cybersecurity technology. 2 years later, the U.S. president vetoed a bipartisan resolution to force stop America's involvement in Yemen's bloodshed. Like Obama, Trump, too, missed all the chances to end this slaughter.
This war has to end.
That's what incumbent Joe Biden said last year, just weeks into his presidency, announcing an end to U.S. assistance for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, as well as relevant arms sales. However, months later, that promise was broken as his government approved two arms deals worth over $1 billion. To support the United Arab Emirates against Yemen's retaliatory attacks, the U.S. is now deploying a destroyer and fighter jets in the UAE, a key member of the Saudi-led military coalition. France also says it will give military support to the UAE to help it protect its airspace. The Biden administration is also planning to bring Yemen's Ansarullah movement back on a U.S. blacklist. Aid organizations warn that the move would prevent the delivery of critical humanitarian assistance to millions of innocent people and could have adverse humanitarian consequences.
It will have much effect on Yemeni civilians because many UN agency and NGOs are working in Yemen. If the United States will continue or if they will declare the Houthi as a terrorist group, this will have a huge and a bad effect on Yemeni civilians.
By sticking to warmongering policies, the current U.S. president is also missing on his chances to stop the war, a conflict that the UN says has already turned Yemen into the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
Now, racial tensions heating up in the U.S. again. Hundreds of protesters turning up in Minneapolis to demand justice for a young African-American man killed by the police. The protesters demanded dismissal and arrest of officers involved in the shooting. They also called for racial injustice, denouncing police violence against black people. Similar events were held in New York City. Amir Locke was shot dead after police stormed into his apartment without warning on Wednesday. Police say that they opened fire after he pointed a gun toward officers. Critics argue that Locke was never given the chance to disarm himself in the chaotic moments. An investigation is going on, and this is the latest incident to put police forces in Minneapolis under scrutiny. Almost 2 years ago, a white officer killed George Floyd, an unarmed black man, by kneeling on his neck for more than 9 minutes. Now, police in the Canadian capital city of Ottawa are asking for a surge of resources to deal with what they are calling the siege of the city by protesters. Ottawa police chief said the truckers' protests against vaccine mandates are triggering, in his words, a nationwide insurrection. Protests have been held in Ottawa as part of so-called Freedom Convoy. Also, other cities, including the financial hub Toronto, have been facing disruptions with truckers blocking roads and shutting down several areas. Quebec has also been rocked by similar events. The movement began on January 22nd after truckers converged in Ottawa to denounce obligatory vaccination for cross-border travelers. It quickly morphed into a protest against COVID restrictions and the government of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Organizers now saying that they are expecting their numbers to swell into tens of thousands. A UN report suggests that North Korea pressed ahead with the development of its nuclear and missile programs last year, and that's despite international sanctions. Based on that report, the country continued to seek material, technology, and know-how for those programs, including through cyber means and joint scientific research. The document adds that Pyongyang also kept developing its capability for the production of fissile materials. Pyongyang is under major sanctions over its nuclear and missile programs. Denuclearization talks with Washington have also stalled. North Korea conducted a record of 7 missile tests in January alone. The country says it feels threatened by the U.S. military presence in South Korea and their joint drills. It says that it needs to boost its defense capacity in the face of potential threats. Now, to discuss that issue further, I'm joined from Hong Kong by Andrew Leung, who is an independent political analyst. Good to have you with us, Andrew. So, what's happening? Pyongyang, does it have justified reason, you know, for being fearful of what's happening in South Korea, U.S. Military support, a bigger budget given to the South Koreans, their joint military exercises that the North calls this provocation, 7 tests there. So, do they have good reason to do this or what?
I think that people need to look at the situation not bit by bit, but its totality over a period of time. Clearly, after so-called six-party talks, which lasted for decades, and also a kind of olive branch held out by President Trump, and then which ended up with nothing, and the North Koreans have lost patience and have lost confidence in the kind of negotiations which is supposed to give the North Koreans some sort of a guarantee, some sort of a security guarantee. But they not only the North Koreans do not get that, but they are now, they feel that they are now pushed into a corner, and now of course as Kim Jong-un has lost complete confidence in these so-called negotiations, and then he's trying to build up his own defenses on all fronts. Missiles, nuclear materials, but at the end of the day, the object of the exercise on the part of the North Koreans is to shore up the legitimacy and the security of this regime, and that depends on bringing better lives and better livelihood to the people. But with all these sanctions, all the people are suffering, and hence even heightened the sense of security. So this kind of a broken record of past failed tactics don't work anymore. In fact, the UN report must be a wake-up call to the United States and other members of the Security Council that really, to deal with North Korea, you've got to think outside the box by reciprocal kind of concessions. In other words, one concession for one pullback from the armament and then building up trust. So kind of step by step. One has got to understand what the Koreans want. They don't want to attack other countries. They are too weak for that. They want national security, some sort of a guarantee, and they haven't got it. So that's what's happening.
Okay, Andrew, how should that happen? I mean, in what form should the guarantee be provided? And the question is if the Biden administration is really serious about this, and if they really want to actually address the issue.
Well, as I said, the thing is that you've got to put some concessions on the table, for example, easing part of this kind of sections, part of this kind of policies which limit the trade for North Korea, the importation of certain material into North Korea, or the export of North Korean products to other countries, because without trade, without investment, the North Korean economy is tanking. So that's no good, and that only serves to heighten the sense of insecurity. But on the other hand, as far as the Americans are concerned, I don't think the Biden administration is in any mood to deal with North Korea. President Biden has got his hands full with Russia in Ukraine and with dealing and containing China, and then with the internal politics, a kind of confrontation of politics with the United States. So President Biden has got his hands full, and I don't think he has got sufficient capacity to deal with North Korea and put it all in. So he's likely to continue with this kind of tactics, which has failed, unfortunately.
Okay. Thanks for that, Andrew Leung, independent public analyst in Hong Kong. That's also a wrap for World News.
Congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
I'm Eric Shimanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of law.
Listeners special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warmest greetings to you all. Welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, February 6th, 2022. I'm Atefa Erfani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails, letters, and messages. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our broadcast. If you have any message for our listeners around the world, then you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard. Please do remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. And here, on behalf of all IRIB English Radio staff, I congratulate you on the 10 days done. That is the period marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran in 1979. Congratulations to all freedom-seeking and all justice-seeking people around the world. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, and as usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. These reception reports are very helpful to us, especially to our technicians and engineers. Actually, these reception reports enable us to provide a better service to our listeners around the world. And all of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving an EQSL card from us, an electronic kind of QSL. So, here, I send my warm appreciations to those of our listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports, including Rob Den Boer from the Netherlands, Kurt Ettlinger from Germany, and Bill McDavid from the U.S. So, Rob, Kurt, and Bill, we want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to your radio, IRIB English Radio. And of course, we've received so many letters and emails from around the world, which some of them focus on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, which I mentioned some of their names here. And later during the program, I will read these emails and letters. Jayanta Chakrabarty from India, one of our regular listeners, has sent us an email. It's a congratulation message. It's such a great email as I can see it. Rob Den Boer from the Netherlands also has sent us an email. Tausif Abbas from Pakistan has also congratulated the anniversary of the victory of Islamic Revolution. Muhammad Khaku, one of our regular listeners from the U.S., has sent us an email congratulating the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. And the last but not the least is an email from India from Mukesh Kumar. So, after a short break, I will be back with these great emails from around the world. Stay with us, please. So we start today's emails and letters with an email from Jayanta Chakrabarty from India, one of our old and regular listeners. It's such a long email, so let's see what Jayanta says. Dear staff, as a long-time regular listener to the useful and informative programs of IRIB English Radio and a well-wisher of Iran, I take this opportunity to wish all Iranian people my best wishes and felicitations on the happy occasion of the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. February 11th is an important day in the annals of the cherished Iranian history. I understand that in 1979, on this very day, the despotic rule of the Shah of Iran was overthrown to establish the modern Islamic state of Iran, led by the able and dynamic leadership of Imam Khomeini, God bless his soul. It is a fact, a wonder, an appreciation, that despite 43 long years of illegal and immoral sanctions of the US and other Western powers, the heroic and dynamic people of Iran have been largely successful in making sustained growth and development in various spheres of human activity. The world has acknowledged the prowess of Iranian research and expertise in agriculture, science, and technology. Today, Iran can proudly demonstrate its spectacular advancement in space and nanotechnology, nuclear energy, medicine, agriculture, engineering, and other high-tech sectors. It has also been largely successful in fighting the menace of the COVID pandemic. Present-day Iran is a regional power and a responsible country in the Committee of Nations. I wish Iran and its hard-working and intelligent citizens a bright future in the days ahead. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you, Jayanta Chakrabarty from India. And many thanks for writing such a great email. And thank you very much for sending us this congratulatory message about the the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran in 1979. And actually, I was surprised by the bulk of knowledge and information you had about the Islamic Republic of Iran and its advancements, its developments. And it was great, as you said, Iran can proudly demonstrate its spectacular advancement in space and nanotechnology, nuclear energy, medicine, agriculture, engineering, and it shows that you are following up the developments in the Islamic Republic of Iran, and of course you are following up the news in IRIB English Radio. Jayanta Chakrabarty from India, many thanks again for writing this email. Write to us soon, and we are looking forward to hearing from you, and we are waiting for such great emails from you about IRIB English radio broadcast and, of course, the developments in Iran. We go to another email from Rob Den Boer from the Netherlands. Rob from the Netherlands says, "Dear Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, I'm glad to confirm your broadcast today. That is 6040 kilohertz here in the city of Hainaut, the Netherlands. I heard at 1945 UTC a female telling a religious story about Islam in English language, which I found it quite interesting. Please verify my report by your EQSL. Thank you very much. First of all, salam and warm greetings from Iran to you, Rob Den Boer from the Netherlands. We are so happy to have this email from you. You heard our broadcast at the information you mentioned in this email, and you heard a story about Islam in English language, which you found it very interesting, and it's great. My colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a confirmation. Thank you very much for writing this email to us, Rob Den Boer from Netherlands. Write to us soon, and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. We are waiting for your views about the programs of IRIB English Radio. And after a short break, I will be back with an email from Tausif Abbas from Pakistan, one of our regular listeners. So here we have another congratulation message on the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, and this time this congratulation message is from Tausif Abbas from Pakistan. Let's see what he says. Greetings and congratulations on the occasion of the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Republic of Iran to you all. What impresses me about your revolution is that how one individual change the whole dynamics of the West Asia region in particular and the world in general. How selflessness of the leader can achieve such a success and can result in ousting of dictators and oppressors. The outstanding features of Imam Khomeini, God bless his soul, as the person were selflessness, the vision, the spirituality, the humbleness to others, kindness and to others, and many others. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you, Tausif Abbas from Pakistan, and many thanks for writing this message, and thank you for sending us this congratulatory message on the occasion of the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, and it was kind of you to express, such information about Iran and actually the selfless and matchless personality of the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, late Imam Khomeini, God bless his soul. Tausif Abbas from Pakistan, write to us soon, and also we are waiting for more views of you, and of course, particularly your views about the programs of IRIB English Radio. And from the U.S., we have an email from Muhammad Khaku, one of our regular listeners. Muhammad Khaku says, sincere greetings and best wishes to fellow Iranians and all well-wishers around the globe on this happy occasion of Iran's 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution victory. It gives me great pleasure to convey my sincere greetings and best wishes to fellow Iranians and all well-wishers around the globe on this happy occasion. The Islamic Republic of Iran is blessed with its oil and gas wealth as well as its highly educated population, which has made formidable inroads in the areas of science and technology. In spite of the sanctions, Iran makes highly sophisticated military and medical equipment, and these all can be enumerated as the fruits of the Islamic Revolution. Salam and warm greetings to you, Muhammad Khaku from the U.S., and thank you very much for sending us this congratulatory message on the occasion of the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. And thank you for reflecting your views about the developments in Iran, and it was great, your knowledge and your information about the advancements of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Iranian people. So Muhammad Khaku from the U.S., write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English Radio programs, and we are waiting for more emails from you and your views about different matters, including IRIB English Radio broadcast. And after a short break, I will be back with an email from India from Mukesh Kumar. So stay tuned. Welcome back. Mukesh Kumar from India has sent us a message. He says, dear sir or madam, greetings. I and my club are English radio enthusiasts. On behalf of all our club members, I send our love to you via this email. God bless you. Salam and warm greetings to you, Mukesh Kumar from India, and thank you very much for sending us this email. We are so happy and we are proud that you and your club members are IRIB English Radio enthusiast. So, Mukesh Kumar from India, why you and your club members don't tell us actually your views about IRIB English Radio broadcast? Yes, we are waiting for them. So write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English Radio programs. Tell us which program or programs you like the best. So here we reach to the next section of our program, which is of course this week's interview, which is conducted with one of our regular listeners. Let's take a listen.
Well, my name is Christopher Lewis. I live in the United Kingdom, in the West Midlands in England. My hobbies include, of course, shortwave listening and listening to other broadcasts from different parts of the world. I also enjoy reading and growing vegetables, gardening, all these different hobbies. And I have to say that shortwave listening is probably my best out of all of these. But in general, I've been reading about the Islamic Revolution quite in depth over the past couple of years. I'm still absorbing lots of information about it. And I'd just like to read some of my personal impressions that I've gathered from reading various sources on the internet and also from books. Basically, the revolution created high moral values in Iranian society. It created a sense of self-respect, and it's also an example to other nations of how society can live together peacefully. The revolution also represented the Iranian ideals and brought them forward. It was also a protest against ancient imperialistic influences as well. And going further on, it also created and brought forward Iran's freedom from oppressive regimes. And it also is an inspiration to a lot of people around the world who are repressed. It also shows the world and proves to the world that Iran, of course, is not dependent on any other nations for its survival. And Imam Khomeini brought into reality all that the Iranian people had hoped for. It's created Iran as a well-functioning nation, and has also enabled the founding of good relations with many nations around the world who value the same high moral standards. And I think that it's most important that we create a sound understanding of each other's cultures, and also improve education about culture, expanding any myths and misunderstanding that can be created by the most part by mass media. From my point of view, and people of similar thinking, that the Iranian revolution has proved that you don't have to be bossed around by any other organization. You don't have to be told how to live. It's sort of like a shining beacon to peoples, you know, around the world, not just in Europe but in other countries of the world. It's proved that it's a strong power, and it's a sovereign nation. It's just very, very encouraging.
And before we wrap up this week's edition of Listeners Special, again, I, on behalf of all IRB English Radio staff, congratulate you on the 10 days done, which is a period marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran in 1979. Congratulations to all freedom-seeking and justice-seeking people around the world on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Dear listeners, please keep in touch with IRIB English Radio. Take care and goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to englishradio@irib.ir. That is one word, englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Once again, our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. 02201-3720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all for being with RIB English Radio.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. President Joe Biden, while on his campaign trail, had said that he would end the war on Yemen when he came into office. Instead, it appears that he has ratcheted up the war on Yemen in the form of military sales. In the span of a very short period of time, the U.S. has sold the UAE and Saudi Arabia hundreds of millions of dollars in military equipment. This edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S. sales and even its presence in the war in Yemen has become more prominent.
When Saudi Arabia launched a war on Yemen in March 2015, it assured the U.S. administration of then-President Barack Obama that it would last less than 7 weeks. But the war, aimed at reinstating a friendly regime in Yemen, has dragged on for over 7 years, with limited military gains for the invaders. Yemeni homes, markets, schools, hospitals, weddings, and funerals have been struck with U.S.-made weapons. An all-out Saudi blockade has exacerbated Yemen's health and nutrition crises, and disease like cholera began to spread like wildfire. And all those came amid military and diplomatic support provided by the Obama administration. Donald Trump, who hailed from the opposite political camp in Washington, followed in the footsteps of his predecessor in supporting Saudi Arabia and made his first trip as U.S. president to the Arab Kingdom. Hours after landing in the Saudi capital Riyadh on May 20, 2017, Trump sealed a $350 billion arms deal with King Salman, the largest such deal in history. Trump had no compunction about the military support. During a visit by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to the U.S., days before the third anniversary of the war on Yemen, he touted finalized and pending sales of military equipment to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. A year later, the U.S. president vetoed a bipartisan resolution to force stop America's involvement in Yemen's bloodshed. In 2021, power changed hands in Washington, but any optimism for a change of policy quickly evaporated.
This war has to end.
That's what incumbent Joe Biden said last year, just weeks into his presidency, announcing an end to U.S. assistance for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, as well as relevant arms sales. However, months later, that promise was broken as his government approved two arms deals worth over $1 billion. To support the United Arab Emirates against Yemen's retaliatory attacks, the U.S. is also deploying a destroyer and fighter jets to the UAE, a key member of the Saudi-led military coalition. In the latest act of military support for the Saudi-led coalition, the U.S. State Department has approved a series of potential arms deals for Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Jordan. Under the deals, both Saudi Arabia and the UAE will receive upgrades to their missile defense systems, and Jordan will get F-16s fighter aircraft. And as long as the U.S. reaps the economic benefits of such deals, the Yemeni people will continue to pay with their lives.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, Emeritus Professor at the University of Wisconsin, Frank Emspach, joins us from Madison.
And Yemeni activist and political commentator Hamza Karim joins us from Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Hamza Karim, first to you over in Toronto. We're looking at another U.S. military sale that's gone on. This one has been an approval made by the State Department for Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and then Jordan. The Saudi deal is worth about $23.7 million. It includes communication and navigation terminals. The UAE approved to buy $65 million in, spare parts for its missile defense, including Hawk, Patriot, and THAAD systems. And then Jordan, which was a big one. We'll get into that later. Why are these military sales happening in such a short period of time? In this case, the point we're zooming in on the UAE and Saudi Arabia.
Thank you very much. This deal just proves to the U.S. involvement in this war in Yemen. I truly believe that, it happened in a very short time, a short period of time, because, of the recent attacks that the Sana'a government or Ansarullah have been launching towards UAE and Saudi Arabia. However, the fact that the state, the Defense Department, they've always been mentioning that the Saudi Arabia and the missiles and the defensive missiles that have been sent in Saudi Arabia, they were able to intercept 90% of the missiles and the drones sent from Yemen. And now they're trying to upgrade the systems for them and sell them more, which it's really contradicting, right? So you're saying that you're intercepting 90% of the drones and the missiles that have been used to attack Saudi Arabia, and now you're saying that you need to upgrade them because basically they're not doing the right job. That's one thing, and the other thing is that at the end of the day, this is the U.S. war on Yemen. This war was announced from the U.S. This war has been continuing for 7 years without achieving any goals because of the U.S. support and backing for Saudi Arabia and UAE.
Mm-hmm. The point that you made there, Frank Emspach, and it comes to you, it's a valid one made there by Hamza Karim. He's saying that when it comes to the statement made by Saudi Arabia and its coalition, in a sense, is that they have said that the success rate is actually pretty high in terms of the interception made on these drones. But at the same time, there's these sales that are happening. Is that part of an agreement that the sales continue to happen to continue this war by the U.S.?
Well, I don't know about agreements, but there was also an arrangement earlier in the week with Qatar, who was not allied so closely with Saudi Arabia, to treat them as a special ally. There is a level of support, it's a gradation of whether you're an ally or whether you have a treaty, and they were upgraded. So what we're seeing here, I think, is a continuation of something that's very, very serious, which is the complete militarization of our policies. And it almost doesn't make much difference which sale is which, because the whole perspective is a military-driven foreign policy. And you see that sort of, that's like the question of the hammer and the nail. To a hammer, the nail is it. There isn't any other solutions. And I think increasingly we're seeing that with American foreign policy. You certainly see that with NATO, where, incidentally, the issues, the arms sales, the treaties, outrun the purpose. As they said this morning, on a variety of different shows, actually, here in the United States. There were people speaking about the situation in Ukraine, and they said, well, you know, if there's a war, the Ukrainians are devastated, Europe is devastated, but NATO as a treaty shows that it's really working. Well, the idea of these treaties and whatnot was to accomplish something. And what we're seeing is a totally counterproductive series of things going on, which hurt the people in all the countries tremendously, especially Yemen. And so there is no other solution. If you talk about this, it's driven in large part by issues that have nothing to do with actually bringing any kind of stability to the area. They seem much more driven by the need that some people have to protect, grow, and support the American arms industry.
Well, why is that, Hamza Karim, that there is no political push or drive even mentioned when we take a look at the news on the war in Yemen coming from the U.S. In particular, but we can hear the condemnations that come on the country that's being bombed, and that is Yemen.
Yeah, if you're asking, as I mentioned.
No, Hamza Karim, go ahead.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, like for the past 7 years, U.S. and Saudi Arabia could not achieve, you know, any of their objectives militarily. And if there is any political, you know, solution that is that will be implemented in Yemen, this will show that, you know, the government or Sana'a or Ansarullah's side is the winning side, because right now, in ground in Yemen, on ground, Ansarullah or the government of Sana'a they're expanding, and they will not, you know, compromise on any deals. So that would definitely show that Saudi Arabia and U.S. lost this war. That's the first point, I think, which is very important. This matter is very important, especially for Saudi Arabia, because MBS, for him to become the next king, he has to prove himself to be a strong man internally, whether the royal family or inside Saudi Arabia. So for him to lose this war, it's really threatening for him to be, it really threatens him to become the next king. The second point is that U.S. there is no reason for U.S. to push for a political resolution here. Their arms industry is booming. They're making billions and billions in terms of economic benefits, and they're not held accountable by the international community, because Saudi Arabia and UAE are really in the in the picture of this war. So for them, I don't see why they would really want a political resolution to take place in Yemen.
Well, Frank Imsbach, 1 year anniversary of President Biden declaring that the war needs to end. The offensive support, as he called it, but that the war needs to end was what this 1 year anniversary Friday marked. You had recently Democrats asking Joe Biden that it needs to clarify U.S. role in the Yemen conflict. And offer more than just vague declarations. I'm looking at the $650 million sale to Saudi Arabia, and then you're looking at this particular sale that has just happened. I don't see anything vague about the U.S. stance at this point, which means, as we have said, military sales. Where did Joe Biden sway from that? Because it looks like he was sincere.
Well, yeah, I think he swayed from it when they're, according to the newspapers, that the Houthis were able to successfully launch missiles and attack the rear of the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates. There are some American troops there, so that's an excuse to always side with the wrong side, I suppose. And I think that internally, our meaning the United States sees its interests as the Saudi interests here, and it certainly sees the arms sales that way. So, given those circumstances, we would side with the people with the cash. And the people with the cash are the Emirates and the Saudis, certainly not the Houthis, right? And so, there's a pressure to do that. And that's why I mean that the sales and things like that outweigh what would really be serious policy considerations about how to bring stability to the Middle East. Let's be serious here. We've invaded. We invaded Iraq. Totally, what everybody admits now is craziness, right? It just simply didn't happen. There were no weapons of mass destruction. but only because we have a completely militarized policy driven in part by a military-industrial complex. I mean, this is old hat in a certain sense, but you're right. There is not a political force in this country that's capable of taking on that complex.
Okay, this is what where it gets confusing, Hamza Karim. You have the news.
Yeah, there'd be something, but we do not see that.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought you were done there. I do apologize for that. Hamza Karim, this is where it gets confusing. When you take a look at the news recently, it keeps repeating one particular stance, and that is there's a new front that has now been opened on the war in Yemen. The Yemeni army has attacked the UAE deep in its territory. And it keeps repeating itself, and then you have other news attached to it that have followed, like developments regarding the U.S. being also involved, where it stepped in. It's shot down a couple of these, drones using the missile defense system, as they call it. Why is it that they call that a new front, but they don't come out and call the over 300,000 that perhaps have been killed or more and keep getting killed as that being a new front? Because those civilian casualties are so much more.
Yeah,
who you are?
Again, this is...
Hamza Karim, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, this is again back to the highly defense. These matters really are related to U.S. interests in the region. The U.S. administration, not only this administration, like if you think about it, since the war started in Yemen, there have been three different administrations that came into power in the U.S. It started with the Obama administration, Trump administration, and now Biden's administration. And throughout the three administrations, a lot of foreign policies have changed for the U.S. But one thing that is really in common between these three administrations is the war in Yemen. None of these administrations really wanted to stop this war, because eventually U.S. really looks at these wars and assess them based on their interests. Attacking UAE, attacking Saudi Arabia really hurts U.S. interests in the region. But killing civilians in Yemen really doesn't mean anything to U.S. So, yeah, again, U.S. is, okay. Based on this, U.S. is moving forward.
Sure. That's exactly a good lead into my question, Frank Emspach, to you. The U.S. is moving forward. It's actually becoming more prominent. I mentioned about how it thwarted, as it said, two of the missiles that were shot from the Yemeni army. It is also now becoming more visible by sending fighter jets, warships to the UAE. We understand, obviously, that the U.S. does have a base in the UAE, but you have the guided missile destroyer USS Cole to partner with the UAE Navy. Why is the U.S., or is the U.S. becoming more physically present in this war, and why did it decide to do to take that step?
I think that we're seeing in part the results of Afghanistan here, where the United States wants to make it clear that we're not going to be driven out of any place in the Middle East, and that we are still the people to have to go to for arms and equipment, and we're going to do that. I mean, let's be serious here. We are sort of tied at the hip with the Saudis. Here you have, if we go back three or four administrations to 9/11, right? The people who attacked the United States were all Saudis, and we attacked Afghanistan. You know, so that was, you would think that we might have some issues with the Saudis or with the murder of that journalist, right? But that's not the case, and so we are wedded to the Saudi regime, which means we're wedded to having MBS become the king and that he be successful. And in order to do that, he's got to win this war, as far as they're concerned. And that's it. And that's what's driving this, I think. And the immediacy, in a certain sense, was the precipitous withdrawal in Afghanistan. There was no reason to do that. You could have worked out an arrangement with the Taliban to have an orderly withdrawal. That's what they were trying to do. And bang, you know. And incidentally, by starving them to death, as we're trying to do also, that is a problem for us. It doesn't look good. So we might as well go ahead and do the military option, because that's really where the United States administration, all of them, have been comfortable.
Trying to understand how that is, Hamza Karim, when our guest Frank Emspach says that the U.S. is tied to the hips with the U.S. Walk us through this. You know, you have Saudi Arabia, in which the Crown Prince is, even by CIA standards, responsible.